Okay, so we'll take care of that later. Hopefully,
yeah.
Okay. And so, Craig, do you want to take? Well, first of all, let me welcome everyone to the March 31st, 2021, 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference. And Craig, would you take the role?
Sure. I have. Is that I have anonymous? Is that Sheila Casey on there?
The very same, Craig.
Sheila Anonymous Casey. So we have Ann Hendricks, Sheila Casey, Andy Steele, Cheryl Curtis. I have I have a Christopher Paulin on here. Is that the correct name, or is it someone else on that line?
Go ahead, Christopher.
That's correct.
Sorry?
That's correct. Christopher Paulin.
That's correct. Okay. And it's P-A-U-L-I-N?
That's correct.
Okay,
yeah,
thank you.
He's from Connecticut, so that's
great.
He's from our group in Connecticut.
Great. Okay. Craig McKee, Dan Hennen, Dick Attlee, Frank Tolopko, Greg Flynn, John O'Malley, John Olson, Lynn Cornelison, Lynn Bradbury, Marty Hopper, Merrill Nass, Paul Zaremka, Peter Ketchum, and I think that's it so far. So.
Okay. Great. All right. So let's see. Are there any? We're going to approve the minutes for last month. Are there any objections to the February teleconference minutes as written and shared? Hearing none, the minutes are approved. Okay. And then on to the approval of the agenda. Are there any objections to the agenda as written and shared? Okay. Hearing none, then the agenda is approved. Okay. So that's great. Just a quick reminder to everybody that we'll be sticking closely to our timeline. So I'll be letting each speaker know when they have 5 minutes left and then 1 minute left. And during the Q&A, if you have a comment prior to your question, please keep it brief so that we can make sure everyone gets a chance to ask their questions. And if time remains, then at the end, we may have an opportunity to go a second round with questions. Okay. And we've been using this for the last few months, and it seems to be working well, so we did it. Okay. And our first speaker tonight, we're honored to have Dr. Merrill Nass join us and share her expertise on the anthrax attacks. And Craig McKee will introduce her. So, Craig, please go ahead.
Okay, sure. Dr. Merrill Nass is part of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, and specifically she's on the Anthrax Committee, and I just recently interviewed her for an article for AE. She was the first person to study an epidemic and show that it was due to biological warfare, which was Rhodesia's anthrax epidemic during its civil war. She's written articles about the anthrax letters, how they should be investigated, and how the FBI's investigation went in many wrong directions. She's given 6 congressional testimonies on anthrax vaccine, bioterrorism, and Gulf War syndrome. And she's involved in the issue of vaccine safety in general. So there's much to say about Merrill. And we're delighted that she could be with us tonight. She's going to give us a kind of a summary of a paper she put together about the FBI investigation into anthrax, and then hopefully we'll have some really good questions for her. And just a quick reminder to everybody to, you know, because we have this problem sometimes on the teleconference, you know, everybody to kind of speak clearly and make sure that they can be well heard, because sometimes the audio quality is, you know, for everybody's line is not always great. So I'm going to hand it over to Merrill, and she can introduce us to this subject, and then we'll ask her some questions. Merrill? Over to you.
Okay, Merrill, before you begin, I'm going to put everyone in lecture mode, and then I'm going to have to unmute you. So if you just hang on for 1 second. Sorry. Okay, Merrill, you're all set. Thank you.
Thanks. So I had trouble. There's so much to this case, deciding what I wanted to say over 20 minutes. And so there's a good chance I'll miss some important things, but hopefully it'll make sense. And you can ask questions and fill in any gaps. So basically, two different sets of anthrax letters were mailed in October, September and October of 2001. The first had rough anthrax, wasn't very cleaned up. There was a lot of debris in the letters, and there was a bacterial contaminant called Bacillus subtilis. The second had no bacterial contaminant, indicating it came from a different batch, was not grown at the same time, and it was very, very clean, and it had silicon and tin in it in the outer portion in a manner that supposedly the United States government has never produced, and the FBI claimed it was never able to duplicate despite trying at least 40 times. Now, after those letters were sent, the FBI embarked in a meandering investigation over the next 7 years and went through at least six known patsies. Eventually, in 2008, they settled on Bruce Ivins after having put a lot of pressure on at least three or four different scientists at Fort Detrick. But Bruce was the probably the least emotionally stable and certainly was the first to crack in terms of what we think was a suicide. So the FBI informed Bruce he was going to be indicted, and he went out and bought twice on the same day Tylenol with Benadryl, two bottles, and while he was under 24/7 surveillance by the FBI, and then went home and apparently drank or ate the bottles and went into a coma, but was not brought to the hospital until slightly more than 2 days later, at which point he was in liver failure from the Tylenol and was allowed to die, basically. And he died on the 29th of July. And on August 1st, big reporter for the L.A. Times, David Willman, you know, got the scoop that we've caught the anthrax attacker. And then over the next 4 days, there was a huge series of scurrilous leaks about Ivan's private life and all the things he had done, et cetera, and they got his brother on television. His brother seemed very weird, and the brother said, oh, Bruce was, you know, very, very strange. And anyway, a lot of leaks to indicate this was a murderous, unstable person. But much of it was not true, and the FBI actually got caught for some of the lies, and surprisingly, they actually had to apologize. So the FBI's Assistant Director for Public Affairs told CBS News on August 5th, quote, what we have seen over the past few days has been a mix of improper disclosures of partial information mixed with inaccurate information and then drawn into unfounded conclusions. None of that serves the victims, their families, or the public. So that's just to begin to tell you how FBI tried to manage this case. The most important thing to note, which perhaps you already do, is that the FBI at that point in time claimed they had solved the case because of this wonderful brand new science that they had developed. They had used 29 laboratories, 60 scientists to do a series of experiments and had proven without a shadow of a doubt that Bruce Ivins and his flask of anthrax held in a cold room at Fort Detrick, to which about 100 people had access, you know, that Bruce was the one. And I'll just quote. Again, after all of the scurrilous leaks, and the admission that the FBI had been lying in those leaks, the FBI then had to resurrect its reputation. So over the next few days, they did two press conferences, and the first was with reporters
who actually asked good questions, which the FBI didn't always answer, and the second was with scientists. And here is what the head fellow from the Justice Department said. Quote, "The key breakthrough was the science that then focused their attention laser-like onto that flask and the person who had control of that flask," unquote. Now I'm going to switch and tell you what the National Academy of Sciences wrote in their report, if I can put my hands on it. Just give me a moment. They said, quote, "In following our charge, we evaluated the specific conclusions drawn by the FBI based on its scientific analysis. The FBI never provided the committee with those conclusions in written form." Okay? So they're charged by the FBI to evaluate the FBI's conclusions, and FBI wouldn't give them the conclusions. They also said, "In the future, among many other requirements, it will be important to ensure more timely results, more efficient environmental analysis, access to globally representative strain collections, and a robust capability for characterizing less well-studied agents. Officials also may need to manage expectations among the general public, policymakers, and the scientific community about the conclusion that can realistically be expected from the use of microbial forensics." So the National Academy of Sciences wrote a book. You know, they had a contract for about $1 million with the FBI to study the FBI science and write a report, which they did. But they were never satisfied by the FBI. Now, the way the National Academy of Sciences works, they have staff, they have committees drawn from members and others, but they have staff who write the reports. And then they have another group of scientists who review them, so that a lot of people go through the language of these reports and make them as whitewashed as possible. So what this report did was use language in a peculiar way, and how they manage that is they explain what they're doing in the body of their text. So they decided that whenever they said "is consistent with," it meant that it was the lowest level of evidence. So that's I'm not explaining it well, but they had four levels of assurance that a conclusion was correct, you know, when they reached certain conclusions. So, if you know, they had the evidence, that would be, you know, it's clear, that would be the top one. The lowest one, when they really didn't have the evidence, they used the term "consistent with." So unless you read that part of the report, those paragraphs which explain their bizarre use of language, you wouldn't know that. So then later in the report, they said, well, this is consistent with this and consistent with that, and it meant that there was really no evidence or very little evidence to support FBI conclusions. All right, let me go back now to just mentioning a lot of things that the FBI did wrong. So there were a number of overseas labs that had anthrax. The FBI claimed that there were only three countries that had Ames anthrax. I actually found five other countries just in a PubMed search, which means I just looked for published papers that mentioned Ames anthrax, and I came up with experiments in five countries in a very quick 5-minute search. So FBI chose not to investigate other countries that had Ames anthrax for their own reasons. And I have always wondered if the anthrax might have come from one of those countries. Let me just throw in here that the FBI claimed that the anthrax was made and prepared in the week before each of the letters was sent. And the reason they justified that for the first set of letters was that it was, you know, the letter said 9/11, and it was apparently mailed or postmarked on the 18th. So they said, well, there was only a week between the, you know, attack on the other attacks and this letter being sent. So it had to be grown within that week. But, of course, that completely evaded the possibility, which to me seemed most likely, that they got some anthrax off the shelf from somewhere, you know, and put it in the letters. Because it's, you know, you don't necessarily have the ability to make enough anthrax in a week to fill these letters. You need large, with anthrax, most labs have equipment to make small batches. And I'm not sure why that is. Some of them, like Dugway, can make large batches, but at Fort Detrick, they only had equipment for small batches, which is where it would have taken a long time. So, anyway, where was I? So, the FBI also decided to simplify their claims that it could have only been done by one person. There could not be any conspiracy. So built into the Amerithrax FBI investigation report is an assumption that only one person did it. And the FBI says, well, they ruled, and that person had to have made the anthrax and then been able to drive to New Jersey to mail the letters in a particular mailbox that the FBI said they found spores in, and then get back to Fort Detrick or wherever they were in time that they wouldn't be missed. And FBI claimed that Bruce Ivins was the only one who could do that. However, if you look more closely, you find that the FBI didn't actually investigate the mailbox until 10 months after the attack. And so there was ample time for them to add anthrax to that mailbox or to just lie about what was found there. I mean, there was no reason for them to wait 10 months to start checking mailboxes for anthrax. So the other way they claimed they ruled people out was using lie detector tests, but they never were explicit about who they ruled out and how they had actually done it. And, of course, people like me don't think they made much of an attempt to rule other people out. They kept saying that it was Ivan's flask, it was under his control, but it had been in two buildings that, as I said, 100 people had access to. So there's no reason to think one of them couldn't have stolen anthrax from the flask. But then it turned out in the National Academy of Sciences report and in the GAO report, which came out respectively in 2011 and 2014, that the FBI was never even able to prove that the spores came from that flask. And in fact, there was no Bacillus subtilis contaminant in Ivan's flask. The spores themselves did not come from that flask. They may have been a later growth. You know, it's possible some of those spores were taken somewhere else and grown up to produce anthrax that was in the letters, but this particular contaminant would have found its way in. And I don't think they could have been grown at Fort Detrick because try as hard as the FBI could, they were never able to find any evidence of this particular strain of the Bacillus subtilis contaminant at Fort Detrick. And the thing about anthrax and Bacillus subtilis, all the Bacillus species, is that they produce their own spore. So once you've grown it in a place, you have these invisible spores that are virtually indestructible. You know, unless you do massive cleaning, like, you know, ethylene oxide for a long time, or, I mean, you can't really clean these places out. And so it's virtually impossible that first batch was grown at Fort Detrick. And the FBI was not able to find any anthrax at Fort Detrick or anywhere else, they claimed, that had the silicon in it in the way the second batch did. So we don't think that was grown there either. Sorry, I'm just looking at my notes. The FBI floated a lot of theories that it had to withdraw later, such as that it was proven that the water the spores were grown in came from Frederick, Maryland, where Fort Detrick is. That turned out to be a lie. They said that the envelopes that the letters were mailed in had only been purchased at Fort Detrick because of some minor defect in the pre-franked envelopes. That also turned out not to be true. And they did a lot of claiming how many minutes Ivan spent in the library at Fort Detrick where there was a photocopier, implying that he used this photocopier to copy the letters, but it turned out that photocopier was not the one that was used. So there were just a lot of specious things in the FBI report. They claimed he was working late at the lab and he had no reason to do so, but once somebody FOIA'd for his lab journals, it turned out he was in the middle of experiments that required him to be there. The therapist who got a restraining order against Ivan's shortly before he died turned out was under house arrest and had a whole litany of prior charges for drugs and guns and then went into hiding, and she seemed to be basically an FBI plant. So.
5 minutes left, Meryl.
Yes. Oh, there were several hoax letters, actually. So a hoax letter was a letter that purported to have anthrax in it, but did not. And these were sent around the same time, and some of them were sent from St. Petersburg, Florida, and one was sent from England, and there may have been one from Malaysia. Stephen Hatfield had a girlfriend from Malaysia and had been in England at the time one was mailed from England. So it was thought that those may have been trying to frame Hatfield. But the thing about the hoax letters was that after the information first came out about them, FBI hushed them up. They never published photographs of the letters like they did of the anthrax, you know, the text of the letters. They didn't, they just pretended they didn't exist. And the reason for that was they were mailed from St. Petersburg and other places, and Ivan's could not have been there at the time they were mailed. And so FBI just pretended they were nothing. So, in the end, as I said, the GAO and the National Academy of Sciences both said that the shiny new science that the FBI relied on basically proved nothing. Even if it had proven that the spores came from Ivan's flask, which it didn't, it wouldn't have proven that Ivan's was the perpetrator, and there was no direct evidence that he was. So he just happened to be the last person who was apparently framed, and he died. And some people think he was murdered. I think probably he committed suicide, but that the FBI probably knew exactly what was happening and failed to notify anyone, because there's an antidote for Tylenol poisoning, which, if given within about 24 hours, will save your life, and that was not offered. And there's no evidence that the FBI told anyone that he had bought Tylenol shortly before he went into a coma. So that's my story.
Okay, great. Thanks, Meryl. We're going to go into Q&A mode now. It'll take a moment. Okay, so if you want to ask a question, again, it's star 6 to get in the queue. And Meryl, while we're waiting for them to do that, we talked earlier before the call started about the vaccines with COVID, and you were going to make a comment about those. Maybe you could do that now while we're... Whoops, wait a minute, let me... unmute you.
Mandate an experimental product. So although the federal government has encouraged employers to instruct their employees that they have to be vaccinated or they might lose their job. There have been several cases where this has occurred, and the employers have been threatened with legal action, and they immediately backed off because they know they don't really have a leg to stand on. So while they're experimental, nobody has to get anything, and there are, and you can contact Aaron Seary, attorney, or you can contact me, and I'll put you in touch with someone who will send a cease and desist letter. Now, the question is, when are they going to be licensed? Because once they're licensed, they can be forced. And that's a very difficult thing to ascertain because the clinical, there are supposed to be ongoing clinical trials, and they call them ongoing clinical trials. But in fact, once they were given emergency use authorizations, the FDA allowed the manufacturers to offer vaccine to all the people who had received placebo vaccines as part of the trial. So basically, there are now no longer an experimental group and a placebo group. So while these people are being followed, they can probably be followed for effectiveness, but there's no control group for safety. And so then the question is, when will FDA decide they have enough data now that they're supposed to have, you know, clinical trials going on for a couple more years, and they said they wanted 4 more months of data, but they didn't get those 4 months of safety data because they've switched over most of the placebo people. So in the earliest case, the FDA could give Pfizer a license as early as June, maybe even May, but there's another legal question, which is, once one vaccine gets a license and becomes fully approved, the emergency use authorization is only supposed to be issued when there is no licensed product available. And so once a licensed product becomes available, does that mean FDA has to rescind the other emergency use authorizations? And I don't think it's going to want to do that because the United States government has bought hundreds of millions of each of them and has a couple more coming up on the way. You know, the AstraZeneca, the Novavax, and what's the last one? I can't remember. But anyway, there are two or three more. So it could be that FDA is not going to want to issue a license for any one until all of them can be licensed at the same time. If that's true, then we might have a year or, you know, quite a long time before they get licensed. And then once that happens, they can potentially mandate them for, the federal government has never mandated vaccines for anyone but the military. So they've encouraged employers to mandate. States have mandated them for healthcare workers or for children in school. So how it would work is unclear. But the vaccine passports apparently are the method by which the federal government could impose a de facto mandate without actually mandating vaccines. So, of course, we're all going to fight vaccine passports as de facto mandates. And I don't advise anyone to be an experimental subject in this huge experiment that the U.S. government is not collecting much data on. But that's your business. All right, I'm done.
Okay, thank you, Meryl. Okay, and we do have a question here from Dick Atlee. Dick, go ahead.
Hi. So there are actually two questions based on the report that you'd made. One, you mentioned that Dr. Hatzell apparently he was sufficiently investigated, and I had thought that he was actually investigated fairly heavily and was able to sue the pants off them because of that. And the other was a comment on the silicon oxygen tin levels. In item number two, you say that the second batch was higher with levels of these than normal. But item number 15 says that you have no documentation on a person who confidentially told you that the silicon levels were very different in the two batches. So that seemed to be an inconsistency, and I'm wondering what actually is going on there.
Okay, so I'll get the second one first, which is the media talked about the presence of silicon and tin at higher levels than normal in the second batch. The question was, and the government tried to obfuscate, is how much was there really in these batches? Because eventually the government tried to say it wasn't any different. The FBI report did not deal with this issue at all. So they just forgot about it. But years earlier, different labs had been measuring using different methods and came up with different numbers. Of course, these are, this is very hard to measure. And so the question was, how much was it really? And, I can't tell you because different places claim different things. But there was definitely too much. I think there was agreement on that initially, and then it was dropped. Going to Stephen Hatfill, I wasn't saying they hadn't investigated him enough. What I said was that the FBI did not admit. At the this time, remember, they're trying to implicate Ivins and ignore everyone else and ignore their prior failures. So what I said, what I intended to mean was that they did not discuss the fact that Greendale, which was on, in the return address, Greendale School, Greendale was actually a suburb of the city where Stephen Hatfill had studied medicine in Rhodesia. That's all I was trying to say, that the FBI lied in its report, or not lied, but misled by saying we looked to find any correlations between the addresses on the envelopes and the people we were investigating. We didn't find any.
Do you think someone was trying to set him up with that?
I think someone was trying to set up a group of at least seven different people, and I think Steve Hatfill was set up, and so was Bruce, and so were several others. But the evidence is good for Hatfill and Bruce.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, and Merrill, I don't know if you're able to talk about this or not, but can you update us on sort of the efforts of the Lawyers Committee on what they're doing with the anthrax in Congress?
I can't. They sent a report to Congress asking to reopen the anthrax letters case, and they're working on a grand jury petition, asking for a grand jury, and where that will go in the middle of, 2021, who knows?
Okay. Okay, thank you. And then we have a question from Bill Wilt. Bill, you're up. Go ahead.
Hi, Merle. My daughter informed me this afternoon that she's joined the guinea pig class and gotten her gene therapy experiment dose, which is upsetting as hell. But so given that we cannot rely on our government at all for any veracity in any area, have you identified any self-help remedies that we might avail ourselves of?
No, there's a lot of people that have always made claims that you can do various things, homeopathics and supplements and whatnot, to alleviate the side effects of vaccines. I don't know whether any of them have any efficacy. It reminds me of a patient who asked me how can he was going through chemotherapy for cancer, how can he make the chemotherapy work better? And I said, the chemotherapy is poison, You don't really want to make it work better, and you don't really want to make it work worse because, they're trying to calibrate the amount you get very carefully, enough to kill the cancer without killing you. And I think the same is true of the vaccine. So if you found an effective way to reverse the effects, would it reverse any possible, effectiveness it would have?
Yeah. Cold comfort.
I'm sorry, but some people are dropping dead afterwards, but most are not. In Norway, 1 in 25,000 young people had a serious. This is with AstraZeneca, which may be the worst one. 1 in 25,000 had a very serious thrombosis of the brain. So that's really terrible, but it was 1 in 25,000.
Yeah, I read some of VAERS or whatever that acronym is, which collects death certificates essentially, I read a few of them. One with the doctor dropping dead as a patient, you know, just a few minutes. I think I got right.
Yes.
Minutes.
Yes, there were people who died, you know, right after the needle was taken out, but that was pretty much in nursing homes, mostly. There were some people who died of anaphylaxis within half an hour. But, you know, I mean, yes, people are dropping dead, but it's not, they're not dropping dead everywhere. So it's, I mean, I can't tell you how unsafe these vaccines are. The CDC and FDA have not provided us any useful data. And those VAERS reports should not be used. The federal agencies are trying to confuse us by giving us VAERS information when they actually have good data that they're hiding.
Good God. How did we get into this fix?
We didn't investigate the Kennedy assassination. We didn't investigate the Maine. You know, we let our government go too far.
Yeah, no, I get that. I always start out with the JFK and then the RFK and all that. And one last question is on the business of whether or not this substance or this ailment, the disease, has been, quote, isolated, end quote, and what the hell isolation means in this context, because we keep hearing, and I hear from
yes.
you, I think, that there has been...
I mean, this story, this question has a life of its own, and I suspect it's, there's a reason for that, and it's not a good one. But all I can tell you is there is definitely a virus. Everything else you've been told is a lie, but there is a virus. And for some people, but we don't know how many, it's really can cause a terrible, terrible illness. But if you treat it very quickly after you get it, before you allow this whole autoimmune process to get going, before you get into cytokine storm and thrombosis, it'll be a minor illness. My colleague, Sinhang Lee, when I have to give a talk on this stupid subject on Friday, and I asked him to back me up because he's a lab physician, and he told me he had bought some SARS-CoV-2 from the American Type Culture Collection, which is the sort of premier, it's in Virginia, place where you get culture. It's where the Iraqi government got some anthrax from. And so he paid $1,200 to get a quarter of an ml of SARS-CoV-2 that had been heat inactivated, and they give you the entire genome. You can't have the live virus because it's considered a select agent, which means it could be used for biological warfare or it could cause a pandemic, and so you're not allowed to have it outside of a high containment lab. So that's why you have to get it heat inactivated, but you can take the heat inactivated SARS-CoV-2 and sequence it, which my friend is doing. And so yes, there really is a virus. My son worked at New York Presbyterian Hospital, as did my daughter-in-law, and they both, you know, saw many patients with it, and my son got it. And they saw doctors and nurses die because this was right last March when nobody knew what to do about it.
Wow. So when it becomes or is isolated in that sense,
so it's isolated. You couldn't sell it to my friend wouldn't pay $1,200 for it if it hadn't been isolated, because he's, you know, he has a lab, he is checking it out,
okay.
And if it wasn't a pure preparation, he would ask for his money back.
Okay, so if it is purified now, what can we do with that whole genome sequencing information? Can we build protections against this stuff, or are we still left as sick babes in the wilderness?
Well, I think we could I'm not a lab doctor, but I would assume that we could develop much better
more accurate tests than we have now, and that we could develop perhaps other vaccines. We already have a lot of drugs that work. So if we didn't suppress those drugs, we would be in good shape. I don't know whether we want a vaccine, because the experimental vaccines, you know, prior to this SARS-2 coming around, were dangerous. So it's like HIV, you know, some things you can't make a good vaccine for, at least with our current level of knowledge, and that might or might not be the case for SARS-CoV-2. But we certainly, I think, could develop better diagnostic tests.
Yeah,
so, Bill, I'm going to cut you off here if I can. There's a couple other people in line, and we're running.
I'm done. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Lynn Bradbury, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Lynn. Hi, Meryl.
Hi.
When you mentioned other countries also had the anthrax and they didn't, the U.S. government didn't look into it, do you think it's possible the U.S. was funding those labs like we probably funded Fauci in China, or Fauci funded the COVID in China?
Well, I think there's a lot that we don't know. I think that there's research that, I mean, we know that Fauci funded China because there were articles published in the open literature that admitted that. We know that not only Fauci funded them, we know that Europe did too, and Australia. There were many countries doing very similar parallel research. But then...
Do you agree with Luc Montagnier, the Nobel Prize winner, that he said several labs around the world, I think Italy included, had identified that it was lab-produced, that COVID...
Yeah, I've been saying that for a year.
Right, okay. They withheld, I know you've said this too, the fact that they've withheld therapeutic cures tells me all I need to know, that it's a criminal enterprise.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And if anybody doesn't know, I would just urge everybody to keep up to date on Meryl's anthrax vaccine blog spot. First thing every morning. Thanks, Meryl.
Thank you.
Okay, and we have another question from Carl Gullivan. Carl, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. I apologize. I called in late, so I didn't hear all of it. But during Q&A, you mentioned that there is some place that one can, as a researcher, one can actually order a vial of SARS-CoV-2 dead. Can you provide the name of that entity?
American Type Culture Collection in Manassas, Virginia. And you can look it up online. I printed out the page. The CDC also said on its website, and I don't know if they still do, that they make it available to, you know, researchers who have the right credentials.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, and Meryl, just one last question from me. So they've suppressed hydroxychloroquine and probably ivermectin. I'm not as familiar with that one. But is that so that they can do the emergency use authorization for the vaccines because they can say there's no other treatment?
That might be part of it, but I don't think that's the whole reason, because a vaccine is a prophylactic and a drug is a treatment, although it might be used as a prophylactic as well. So with anthrax vaccine, it was issued an emergency use authorization, even though there were antibiotics that could be used to treat anthrax. So therefore, I think they could have used that same justification to have still issued the EUA. Therefore, I think that the main reason that the use of both of those drugs have been suppressed has been to prolong the pandemic, to give them, the other side, enough time to roll out all these changes that they want, such as vaccine passports, digital currency, and things like that, which they couldn't just do quickly. The one purpose of the lockdowns, in my view, was to prolong this whole pandemic period, because if you just
let everybody be together, the infectious disease would run through your population and you'd be done with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, we have one more question, and then I'm going to have to cut the Q&A off. So here we go. Lynn Cornelison, please make it quick. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, this is Lynn from Iowa. What do you know what Charles Lieber was doing in the same Wuhan
lab
since 2011?
No idea.
And he was arrested January 28th, and he was the head of the Harvard Biology and Chemistry Department who specialized in nanoscience.
I wish I knew.
Yeah, I wish I knew, too.
All right. Thank you, Lynn. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So, Meryl, thank you very much for joining us today. I really appreciate your contributions.
Thank you.
And hope you'll join us again when you are down the road and keep us updated on things.
Great.
And you're welcome to stay for our next speaker, or I know you're a busy woman, so if you need to go, that's fine also.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, Meryl.
Okay, so now we're going to go back to lecture mode and let's see. And okay, so our next speaker is Craig McKee, and he doesn't need an introduction, but I'm going to give him one anyway here. So Craig has been a journalist in Montreal for more than 30 years. He's covered news and entertainment, and he's won 8 provincial and national weekly newspaper awards. He created the website truthandshadows.com, which I know most of you are familiar with, and he's been with the teleconference since 2011, first as a secretary and currently as the co-facilitator. And he also is putting his journalistic skills to use by working for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And here he is, Craig McKee. Craig, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Cheryl. I assume that I'm unmuted and everything. Okay. So,
yep,
yeah,
I can hear you.
Okay. Excellent. I can sort of, it doesn't bring me a lot of joy to be bringing this topic up. I'm going to do it because I think it's important that people understand some things that are going on that are not, that otherwise they wouldn't even be aware of. I mentioned, those of you who recall, who were around 2 years ago on this call, we had a very contentious call in February of 2019 where I detailed a campaign, quite an involved campaign orchestrated by the Pentagon group that I often talk about, but specifically David Chandler and Jenkins, Wayne Costi, were people that had commented on in some of this campaign. It was basically complaining about me was a big part of it, and it was urging not only some of the staff at Architects and Engineers, but also the board of directors to fire me because of things I had said about the Pentagon and criticisms I had made about this group. Of course, that didn't happen, which I'm very happy about. But what I understand to be the case, and it's truly kind of amazing that this is the case, but this campaign is still going on. Now Fran Schur has joined, and she's now urging Architects and Engineers to get rid of me as well. So this campaign has gone back. It goes back at least 3.5 years because I remember reporting it in February of 2019 that it had been going on for about 18 months at that point. So the reason I bring this up is because I know that I'll be accused. And some people will think, well, why are you bringing this up? Why are you pushing this? Why are you, exaggerating these divisions? And I'm actually not the one doing it. I'd like to see that group, honestly, stop pushing element after element after element of the official story at the Pentagon, but I realize that I'm, you know, that that's unlikely to happen. But what they're doing is they don't like me criticizing them, and so they're looking for a way to silence me, and the way they've decided to do it is to go to architects and engineers. And this is really unfair and wrong, because I don't want architects and engineers to be brought into this. This is not their fight. They deal with the World Trade Center evidence, New York City. They are really the most reputable organization that the Truth Movement has. And it is my great honor to be involved with that organization. And I have been involved with them since 2014, first as a writer, a member of the writing team, and I still do writing today. So I'm delighted to be working with them. And when I'm working with them, I'm not talking about the Pentagon. I'm talking about the evidence that they're dealing with. I'm helping in whatever way I can to put forward their mission. Now, in my own time, I have very strong views on the Pentagon, and I have very, very strong views about some of the tactics and the, I think, devious and deceptive tactics of this group that I've mentioned, and I believe those tactics need to be called out, because a lot of people just don't realize what's going on. And I could get into a great deal more detail about that. But let me just say that, you know, I really don't want – they're the ones that are trying to bring AE into this. I don't want that. So why don't they just, denounce me publicly if they want to. I don't care. But this business of going behind my back to people at AE and trying to convince them that they have to get rid of me is really low. And there's an irony in this, because back when I made a presentation in December, the beginning of December, I was criticized by Fran Schur for going behind David Chandler's back, even though this group is public, the recordings are posted on a website, anybody can listen, and virtually anybody can come to the calls and participate. So there's nothing secretive about it. But after denouncing me for going behind David's back, then Fran writes to architects and engineers urging that they fire me, which seems to me to be going behind my back. Now, I realize that she doesn't think that my criticisms are fair, and I'm quite happy to have that discussion and that debate, because I can chronicle in quite a bit of detail the real tactics of this group. You know, the way that Fran put it on December 2nd was that her group are scientists, and they speak at the level of evidence. And our group here, which she said is not a real truth group, we deal in belief. And this is spin that this group has been using for at least 5.5 years, because it was Ken Jenkins in 2015 who started introducing this idea I lost my train of thought there. In 2015, that was when he sort of first introduced this idea of the psychological aspect of belief versus, evidence. Like the people who think that there was no plane impact at the Pentagon, well, we just have confirmation bias, and we're just going on belief. And Fran is, continuing this, this sort of tactic of painting them as being they're the scientists, and everybody else is kind of superstitious and believing in a position rather than following evidence. But the truth of the matter is, and this is something I don't really want to get into a lot of detail about it, but I will if asked. This group has done exactly the opposite of what it pretends to be doing, and it's done it a great deal. I mean, the attacks against the Citizen Investigation Team group, which isn't even active in the in the movement anymore. It hasn't been active for almost 8 years now, but they are still attacked relentlessly as being fraudulent, as being deliberately deceptive. You want to talk about evidence-based, you know, they're referred to as fast-talking telemarketers by David Chandler. I don't think that's scientific, and I don't think that's evidence-based. So there's a huge amount of hypocrisy in all of this. And all I'm trying to say is, you know, let's have whatever changes we're going to have about the Pentagon and you know, accept criticism where criticism's due. I'm certainly prepared to I've accepted quite a few attacks publicly on social media and all kinds of places for my position. I certainly get attacked by their hangers-on on a regular basis. I mean, there was, you know, somebody who's an avid supporter of theirs who just happened to write to AE shortly after Fran did, kind of urging that I be fired. So that was, I'm sure, not a coincidence. There's a whole orchestrated effort behind the scenes that most people aren't aware of. And it's not just two or three people. There's a whole group of them that are lobbying and pressuring and getting in touch with people and trying to turn people around. So they're free to do that. You know, they're free to do that. And I'm free to denounce them if I think that I have reason to do so. So I'm not trying to cause dissension or division or problems. I would rather not be saying these things tonight. I'd rather be talking about something else. But, you know, it should be known that this is a tactic that this group is using. It is, you know, they would love to be able to just dismiss me, but the fact that I'm working with architects and engineers makes it more difficult for them. So they want to get me out of there. So, you know, I just, that's fine if they want to try that. But I don't think they should be able to get away with doing it in secret, you know. And this communication that I'm referring to, it went to several different people at AE, and it shouldn't be a great surprise that it would come to my attention at some point. So, I mean, there's so many things I could talk about. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I find, I'll mention something else that. It's not just me. I'm not trying to make this sound like I'm the one that's the victim or anything, but they're also trying to do a real job on Barbara Honegger, who's a regular. She hasn't been in our call in a while because I think of a conflict, but they've been attacking her in a very systematic way for quite some time, and I think it's quite reprehensible what they've been doing to Barbara. So it's. You know, and then we hear about how people are on my side of the issue are, you know, how we're ostracizing people who don't agree with us. And there's the hypocrisy of the whole thing is quite amazing. So I'm not sure if I want to. I mean, there's a great deal more I could say. I'm not sure if I want to go a whole lot far. I'll mention one thing more, and then I'm sure we'll have some questions. At one point, and I may have mentioned this in December, and if I did, I apologize for being repetitive, but at one point there's a troll named Adam Fitzgerald who posted a list of infiltrators on Facebook, and this list included Barbara Honegger, it included CIT, which is Aldo Marquis and Craig Ranke, it included Loose Change, which is Dylan Avery and I guess Jason Burmes. Now, you know, that's all. Dylan Avery is the guy that directed Seven, which is the new Architects and Engineers documentary that's very, very successful and is, you know, extremely popular. And when this list was posted on Facebook, David came back with good list. And then he said, it's hardly surprising that there would be infiltrators in our movement. So, you know, this idea that they're the objective scientists and everybody else is kind of slinging mud is simply not true. So I'm going to stop there. There's other stuff I'm sure that'll come up, and I hope that we can be civil in whatever this discussion is left. Maybe we can, you know, in future we can stop with the backdoor tactics, and we can just take our positions and take our lumps publicly when we deserve them, make our criticisms. I'm quite prepared to be criticized publicly. But what I can't stand is people going behind my back in secret to try to, you know, get me booted out of that organization. Anyway, I'll stop there because I could go off in all kinds of directions. So that's where I am, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay.
and comment.
Okay, thank you, Craig. Well, let me get it into Q&A here. And you're still unmuted, correct? Yes, okay. And I just want to remind people again to be brief. Thank you. And so if there's any questions or comments, star 6. Okay, we've got a couple here, so we'll get started. Bill Wilt, you're first. Go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah,
we can hear you.
It's Bill Wilt. So I was looking around for my hearing aids. I couldn't find them, and I just make a kind of procedural request for those of us who are I'm turning 77 tomorrow, who can't hear very well anymore, or at least have suffered some tinnitus or hearing loss, that you would always be careful to speak right into the microphone. So that's one thing. The second thing that occurred to me, I don't know if you've touched on it because I was away for a while. Is anybody taking seriously the possibility that we could get metal detectors all over the lawn on the Pentagon and also up in Shanksville and start? I mean, we've got all this side-looking radar for oil geophysics exploration and all that. We've got technologies that can let us find metal fairly deeply underground. And it would be great to just, have a civilian posse of thousands of metal detectorists, I guess they're called in Britain, the detectorists, going over this territory and seeing what we can find. Because I don't think they're thorough enough to, I mean, they can't even keep their fake stories straight, our government. So it's possible that they've missed stuff that we could find. Over.
Okay. Well, that's an original suggestion, Bill. And I like it. I can't imagine they're going to allow civilians onto the Pentagon lawn with metal detectors. But it would certainly be interesting if they did. I mean, one thing that strikes me about the Shanksville thing, which it might, you know, might be a little bit easier there, although they do have a memorial there. But, I didn't even realize that the official story claims that the plane is actually still buried at Shanksville. I didn't even realize this until maybe a couple of years ago. I just assumed they were claiming it had been dug up, but apparently not. Apparently the official version is that it's still in there. So I wonder what a metal detector would turn up. I don't know. The problem is, if you detected something, what would how would you get at it? You know, that would be
right. Well,
I'd wonder.
Other thing, Craig, is that the site at which there is a memorial, I believe, is a site where it's alleged to have gone down, which, as we probably know, was the debris field was 8 miles long, and it was located in some other place than where the Shanksville Memorial is. So if you got into the Shanksville Memorial turf, literally turf, and subsoil, you wouldn't find anything there anyway because they didn't where it crashed. It went down some 8 miles further, I think, northwest maybe, or maybe southwest. I don't know what the one the FBI demanded that the owners of this cabin in the woods be a quote team player end quote and shut up forever. Over.
Okay.
Well. Yeah. All I'll say is, you know, that the one thing that seems the most impossible to me, and, you know, I think there can be a lot of discussion about, you know, what did happen, but one thing that seems really clear to me is that there isn't a 757 buried under that field where that gouge was in the earth. That seems to me to be something that most 9/11 truthers agree on. Although I think we're going to see more and more said that about that in the future, perhaps arguing the opposite. But we'll see about that. But
okay, all right.
Before then.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Bill. Okay, moving on to the next question. Christopher Paulin, you're next. Go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
I just would just like to say that all the views should be heard. So if you have evidence, you just present your evidence, and then other people can disagree or agree regarding your story about architects and engineers and, you know, what you were saying before.
Right.
I think just allow people to present evidence, you know, and if they have a different idea, you know, that's how innovation is done. You have all kinds of ideas to innovate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I completely agree with that. You know, and everybody is free to present their evidence. But also, everyone is also free to criticize evidence that's brought out. And, you know, my main beef with this group that I'm talking about, it's not that they present their opinion. They're perfectly entitled to present their opinion, but their opinion, what they do is they focus almost entirely on things about the Pentagon official story that they agree with. And the very few areas where they say they don't agree, such as who was in control of the plane, we don't hear much about that at all. They don't seem to want to focus on the areas where they might challenge the official story. All they do is keep trying. They're basically challenging the truth movement by going against positions that go against the official story. And I'll just finish this answer by just saying that, you know, almost every time I get accused of claiming that they support the official story. I hope I've phrased myself precisely enough tonight, and I hope, because this is what I do every time, and it always comes back, like, well, you say they support the official story. I don't say that. I say precisely what I said. But I certainly agree with you that people have to be able to give their evidence. But, you know, sometimes there's more to what they're doing, and sometimes that needs to be called out. It's not telling anybody, you know, you're not entitled to give your position. Certainly they've been doing that for a decade or more. So nobody's been stopping them. So it's a tricky situation. I'll just say that.
Okay, thank you, Christopher, for your question. Next, Lynn Cornelison. Lynn, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Craig. This is Lynn from Iowa.
Hi, Lynn.
Well,
hi, Lynn.
It seems obvious to me who the real infiltrators are here, that Chandler and gang. They want to take over, disrupt, destroy AE, and have you kicked out in Honiger too, so the thing starts losing its wheels. And I'm wondering, is Richard Gage kind of staying out of this with Chandler, possibly because it might disrupt the lawyer's case in Manhattan because of Chandler's contribution of getting NIST to admit the 2.23 seconds of pre-fall Building 7, or what would that be? And I mean, he could probably just fire himself. Seems like to me he's the top dog. What's your thoughts?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm so happy to be working with Richard and with the rest of the group at AE. And, you know, Richard has maintained over the years and still does that it's the New York City evidence, it's the World Trade Center evidence that AE is involved with and has in it. And by sticking to that, they really have been such an effective vehicle for the movement. If they kind of went into other areas, then, you know, that would not, that would, you know, weaken them, I think. So they're, so I think he is, you know, quite wisely staying out of this fray. And I think we're all the beneficiaries of that, because Architects and Engineers is such a wonderful organization. I'm, you know, never cease to be impressed by how effective they are and the important work that they're doing. So I'm just going to suggest that keeping it that way is probably what's best for all of us.
Yeah. What could be a successful resolution of this so it doesn't just keep going on with people going behind your back?
Well, I don't think this group is ever going to stop doing what they're doing, which is why I call them a cabal, and why I think that the operation is not a genuine one, because I think it goes back much beyond 10 years ago. I mean, this all, you know, things got, the David Chandler aspect of this really got going in 2011 when he and John Cole wrote a paper we're talking about CIT group, and, you know, suggesting that they had, that their theories were deliberate, they were false and deliberately planted to make the movement look foolish. So, you know, this idea that this feigned outrage about, you know, people accusing, you know, about my use of the word cabal and the suggestion that the campaign is not genuine. Well, you know, they've been doing that since 2011 and beyond, if you want to go to other people who have been pushing this as well. So, you know, I've completely forgotten what your question was.
I think you've answered.
First one or second?
Yes.
Did I answer? Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Lynn. All right.
Okay.
We'll move on here. Andy Steele, you're up next. Go ahead.
All right. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. So I just wanted to put my own kind of statement in here because I found myself on the receiving end of this inquisition along with our chief operating officer, Kelly David. And my only crime was not bringing David Chandler on my show to talk about the Pentagon evidence. We did a debate at one point on my show about the Pentagon because a debunker made a request in order to do it with Craig. And, you know, I mean, it was an okay show, but it was just, you know, they spent the whole time arguing one single point. I realized that this would be a 30-hour ordeal if I was to continue doing this. And I also just didn't want to bring on David to present his point because, you know, people see him as being affiliated with AE. And if he's talking about this, and it sounds like AE has a Pentagon position. So I respectfully said no. And I was met with a request by the board to try to force me to put him on my show. So, you know, the thing is, this whole situation does not make me very happy. I mean, the job is tough enough and stressful enough without having to deal with members of the Truth Movement going on a campaign like this. But I just want to back Craig up, and I want to do it publicly because, first of all, we're not going to fire Craig. Craig is a good volunteer. He's actually, he's a good person with us. He's been a good writer for a number of years. And Craig never asked AE to get involved in this Pentagon fight. Now, I did talk to David Chandler about the situation at one point. I was challenged to look up his name on Truth and Shadows in the search box and see how many instances, 30-something instances, in which Craig is defaming him. That number is not accurate because I took him up on this challenge. Most of the time, it's stuff Craig's saying. You know, I understand David Chandler wrote a paper. I haven't gotten to it yet. At least in one instance, there was suggested articles where David Chandler was mentioned in the other article, but it was at the bottom of this particular article that's being counted as one of the 30 instances in which Craig is defaming him. But what I did learn, what I didn't know, I knew for years that this war was going on over the Pentagon. Did not care. This was not like in my wheelhouse, and I was perfectly fine with working with both people, promoting both people whenever it was appropriate to do so. I used David Chandler's video sometimes as filler on the show if the interview ran short for whatever reason. But what I did learn is that actually this whole thing started when this group of people decided that it was important to try to go on this crusade to cleanse the movement of people who think that the no 757 hit the Pentagon that day. Now, my position on this is that, you know, when you do something that's going to possibly be controversial, you know, that is your crusade. So you deal with the consequences of that. You know, if I go out and if I wanted to make a crusade going after people who don't think or an airplane hit the World Trade Center, you know, and then people started criticizing me back. Now, I think that's a completely deplorable theory, and you know, it's not even worth my time. But if I decided to do that, I would have to deal with people criticizing me for that who believe that. You know, when you speak out on this, and especially if you get publicity working with AE, you become kind of a quasi-public figure, and that just goes with the territory. So this basically, you know, they started attacking these CIT people. Craig came to their defense, and it became a war between them. And this went on for years, and it wasn't a problem. And I wasn't even here before the attacks on the CIT people. Like, I was in the 9/11 truth movement. There were people who didn't believe a plane hit the Pentagon. There were people who did. Everybody got along just fine. It wasn't this controversial thing where everybody's at their throats like it is now. And it was started because of this crusade, this inquisition. And that's really what it has been. I've seen, to my satisfaction, a bullying effort against people in the movement to try to, you know, distance from this position, even if they don't really have much to do with it, but mainly to distance from Craig McKee, because Craig basically had the guts to not cater to this, you know, to speak unapologetically about it. So, you know, I'm not taking, you know, I have my own opinions of the Pentagon. I'm not taking a side, and certainly AE is not taking a side. So all we've asked is to respect our neutrality. And the analogy that I use is that, you know, imagine AE is like the United States of America, and you've got two countries in Europe, France and England, that are going at war, have been at war for 50 years or something. And we want to trade with both. We want to, you know, do business with them and everything. One side is respecting that. The other one is trying to overthrow the government of the United States because they're trading with the other country, you know, attacking them, writing to the board, trying to get staff members fired for their association with Craig McKee. And, you know, which one are you going to have a problem with in that instance? So you're liable to hear in the next year a lot of chatter about, you know, AE's taking a position on the Pentagon, that there's infiltrators at AE who are trying to push this No 757 hit the Pentagon thing. That is absolutely false and a complete lie. The issue is the behavior. And I don't think that this group is used to people standing up to them, and we're just not going to tolerate it. So,
okay, thank you. Thank you, Andy.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Craig, did you want to respond to that? Or?
No, I won't, other than to say, you know, I appreciate Andy's remarks, and I think, you know, what he said is true. You know, there is, I would reiterate the idea that there is what the other group is claiming is happening is often the very thing that they're doing while pretending to be the victims of bullying and ostracizing and all this sort of thing. Meanwhile, they're engaged in a pressure campaign that is largely behind the scenes, that has just been ongoing for years and years and years and years. And if they can't kind of persuade you that your view is wrong, they've given up persuade. They know they won't persuade me. So they have to choose other methods to try to push their case. And I find the whole thing to be very disturbing that, You know, the point is often made that, you know, well, there's lots of things correct in the official story. I mean, you know, planes hit the towers. That's in the official story. We don't disagree with that. You know, as if I'm saying that every single thing in the official story is false. That's a straw man, of course, because I've never said such a thing, nor do I think that. But I think, as I may be repeating myself, but as I said before, When you're only talking about the things that you agree with in the official story, and we are talking about the Pentagon here, we're not talking about New York City. When you're only talking about the things that you agree with in the official story, and you really make very little mention at all of anything you disagree with, then it becomes frankly suspicious after a while. Because, I mean, I think as a 9/11 truther, what I'm thinking is, you know, the thing that bowled me over originally, after I went through the whole thing about the towers and I learned I was reading David Ray Griffin's books and all kinds of stuff, it was that combined with the Pentagon, combined with Shanksville, combined with learning about the war games and the fact that planes weren't intercepted, and I mean, all kinds of stuff, you know, cumulatively, led me to say that this whole official story is nonsense. So I would think that even if we don't all agree, surely we're agreed that the official story is false. So let's focus on challenging that and try to make that point to people outside the movement, that we've got good reason to challenge this. This group has spent the last decade or more focused almost exclusively on telling us that actually there's all kinds of correct things in the official story and focusing on those, all under the guise of protecting our credibility. And I have a big problem with that. So anyway, thank you, Andy, for those comments.
Okay, thank you, Andy. And next up is Dan Hennen. Dan, go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hi. This is Dan Hennen. I serve on the board of 9/11 Truth Action Project, which is TAP. I'd like to say thank you for Craig, how you've handled this whole situation. You've done it very good. The folks that we're up against here are, in the true definition of the word, infiltrators. And what they're doing is pushing it back on us as being the infiltrators. Now, I've got some other views myself on things with 9/11, but while I'm in the TAP group or posting for TAP on Facebook or social media, I wear that hat, much like Craig wears his hat, with AE 9/11 Truth. When he's not under AE 9/11 Truth, he's very active in the Pentagon topic, and he's very active in other things, much less similar that I am too. But the way to understand the behavior of the infiltrators is that what they're trying to do is slowly inch their way closer to the official narrative. And what we're seeing with the Pentagon is they're getting everyone to believe that a large plane did impact the Pentagon. Well, that's fine. Believe it if you want. The thing that scares me and Craig as well is that what we're seeing in the last since this last fall is the same group is now trying to persuade more folks to say that, you know what, a large plane did land in that hole in Shanksville. And so what they're doing is the playbook over and over and over again. You know, next will be, you know, what happened at World Trade Center. Now, bless his heart, David Chandler did a lot of good work in Manhattan, but you've got to watch someone who has been altered or turned or changed over the course of the years, and this group is bad. Now, once these bad guys, I'll call them, found out that I had issues on other things and other topics and other concerns, I got a letter written to our board chairman saying we want to have Dan Hennen removed as a board member because he has differing thoughts than us. And that's when I started making the accusations of infiltrators in our group pointed at the very direct people that's doing this. And boy, when you say bullying, they are expecting you to go quietly and put your head down to what they say. Once you stand up, like Craig and I have done, and Barbara Honegger have done, the three of us then have been taking the target directly on our backs. And so they will come after you big time and get their legions. Adam Fitzgerald is a longtime infiltrator that we've all known about. He is the one that directly wanted me off the board that I'm on for 9/11 because he said, I'm an infiltrator. So what they'll do is turn it exactly around. But what we can see take place, what these lunatics are doing is now they're going on the next chapter of their little book to say, you know what the truth really happened at Shanksville was United 93 fell in that hole. Now we all know that's obviously nothing further from the truth. So you must ask yourselves, why are they trying to push us closer to the official narrative? Well, that's what infiltrators do. Thank you once again, Craig, for standing up. We had a cease and desist letter go out from AE 9/11 Truth, Richard Gage himself, to an individual that's now joined this same group. And so there's a lot going on behind the scenes that the public is not aware of. And this person who was upset at that decided to take it upon himself to go after Craig McKee, and I had to stand him up, but stand behind him on Facebook. But this takes a lot of time and energy for those of us fighting this battle. And I think it's a good point, Craig, that you brought this up, because the everyday truther is not seeing this going on behind the scenes. Over.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. I appreciate those remarks. And the person you just referred to, who was the recipient of that letter, that cease and desist letter, on Facebook, yeah, he went after me. I mean, I kind of engaged him too. So, but it's interesting that he started hitting back with stuff that he really couldn't have known about himself, that only could have come directly from this particular group. So he's getting his information from them. So the fact that he's been basically told to stop harassing AE, and, you know, and that's where he's getting information, I think is worth taking note of. But anyway, thank you for those comments, Dan. Appreciate it.
Okay, and we did have one other question, but it's gone out of the queue. It looks like the person has hung up. So, okay, so that's the end of the questions then. Let me just make sure I didn't miss her. No, she's gone. Okay. All right, so thank you, Craig, for that. I really appreciate your presentation. And that brings us to the point in our call where we're going to take announcements. Any news updates? So let me do the end of the Q&A. Okay, so any announcements? Anything anyone wants to share?
Hello?
Yes?
Hi, this is Lynn. I just want to remind people that if anyone becomes aware of employers formally demanding mandatory vaccines, that they contact Robert Kennedy at Children's Health Defense, who will probably pass them on to Del Bigtree at the Highwire for advice and help with any lawsuits that should be made in the event of those illegal demands for mandatory vaccines to be employed.
Yeah, that's really important. Thanks, Lynn, for that.
I mean, keep up to date with Robert Kennedy at Children's Health Defense and his defender, and Del Bigtree. They're both doing extremely important work, and if anybody has any dollars to send each month, they're well worth supporting for their legal efforts on behalf of all of us. Because where the government can't legally demand the mandatory vaccines, because as Merrill said, they're still emergency use, people need to know. And in Maine and in New Mexico, as in Ohio first, there are lawyers suing the state against the states of emergency. So Maine, I just became aware of this site because of John Olson. It's called MaineStandsUp.org, and it may be a mostly Republican site, but I think we need to make these alliances with people who are doing the important work. And the lawyers who are interviewed, go to MaineStandsUp.org and follow any links you can. You'll see links to protests against the lockdowns happening worldwide, and equally or more important, these legal cases being initiated. And the lawyers are very well spoken and worth listening to. MaineStandsUp.org. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
John O'Malley, any word on the email listserv?
Craig, do you want to address? Let me just take Craig off of this.
Am I? Okay, am I? Did you unmute me? Okay. Yes, good. We have a group created. I mean, I've been a bit busy and distracted lately. So what I really need to do is to send out invitations, email invitations, or just add people to the group. Right now there's just I think Cheryl and I and Barbara Honegger are in there and maybe one other person, but it's just a question of adding the people who were on the listserv before and anybody else that would like to be part of it. So we just haven't really got it rolling yet, but the group is there. It exists. So I just have to get off my butt, I guess, and add people who want to be in there. I don't know if I, other than sort of adding in the people who were in it in the old one, I'm not sure if I know sort of who does and who doesn't want to be involved in the new one. It might be helpful for people to actually email me and say, you know, yeah, please add me, or no, please don't add me, because I don't want to add anybody without their, you know, without their permission. So
was this the 29 pages?
No.
29 pages listserv?
No, Bill.
No.
This is a. Go ahead, Greg.
We had a listserv that was in Yahoo groups, in two major stages, they basically closed down all their groups, so there are no Yahoo groups anymore, which means that whole listserv doesn't exist. So we had to kind of go out, you know, looking for another forum, and the suggestion was made that that we try Google groups, and it's pretty similar. We all know that there's always a danger that, you know, censorship will happen or whatever, but at least for the time being, you know, it seems to be it seems like it would kind of meet our needs. But it's a Google group, so it exists, it's been created, and it's just a question of getting people in there and having people start to post.
Yeah, that would be great. We'll try and work on that and have it up and ready for the next meeting.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Yeah. Yeah. So thanks for asking about that. I have a couple announcements here. One is that globalresearch.ca, you know, the website with Michelle Trzodowski, they started today a webinar, and I just happened to get the email and joined it. It was at 4:00, and they had over 100 people from around the world on this webinar, and they were talking about the COVID situation and, you know, lockdowns and vaccines and what we do about it. So I think they're going to be doing something more frequently, so just pay attention to that, because it was really worth listening to, and I learned a lot from it. So, and if we get our listserv up, then we can send around when they're going to do that next. In terms of what Lynn was saying about if you have a legal problem where they're trying to force you to get a vaccine, there's a group of paralegals that are helping people with that also. And their website is COVIDLegalUSA, and I don't know if it's .com or .org, but it's COVIDLegalUSA. So they will also give you help. So
Cheryl?
Yeah.
Hi, Carl Golovin just had a brief announcement.
Yep. Yeah, go ahead, Carl.
Okay, thanks. I just stumbled across an announcement that there's an in-person live conference in Rapid City, South Dakota on June 5th and 6th, sponsored by G. Edward Griffin's group. The website is redpillexpo.org, and it's, of course, going to be coronavirus-centric. I saw Del Bigtree is among the many speakers, but Richard Gage as well, so I'm sure it'll be an opportunity for 9/11 related discussion. It would be really a great opportunity for all of us who hear each other on the conference call periodically to gather somewhere somewhat central in the country that there's hardly ever an opportunity or a reason to drive or fly to South Dakota, but this might be a good opportunity.
All right, thanks, Carl.
Please repeat the name of it.
Redpillexpo.org.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think South Dakota is the only country state that has a state bank that's run under the Constitution. Just an FYI.
South Dakota has not been locked down at all during this whole time. And it's both a virtual and in-person conference, but yeah, probably a lot of us have been starved for in-person gatherings this last year, so might be an enjoyable trip.
Amen.
And Cheryl, the COVID legal, how does that end? COVID legal dot something?
USA. It's COVID legal USA.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's .org or .com, so you'd have to check that out. Yeah, and they also have a COVID blog, so if you go to their website, where you'll also see where there's people discussing different aspects of it. So there's also
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anything else? No? Okay. Well, I guess that ends another teleconference, and the next one is at the end of April, and if anyone has any ideas for speakers, please let us know. And,
thank you very much. This was great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for what you do.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
You all. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Everybody. Very Thanks good. For being part of it. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.